right, good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, February 10th, 2015. And this says Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Oh, happy Tuesday. At least the show started off with my microphone working this morning. I don't know, some funky stuff going on here. Nobody touches anything, and all of a sudden it doesn't work. Gotta love when that happens. It is 19 degrees and overcast here in upstate New York. I looked out the back window, finally stopped snowing, but my 4-foot fence only has about 1 foot left before it's under snow. So there's about 3 feet in the backyard. I see it appears that a deer may have attempted to trudge through the yard and might have sunk. There's a pretty deep hole that looks like he leapt a few feet and then maybe turned around and went back into the front yard. It is deep out there. So count yourself lucky if you're down south or out to the west where they had 80 degrees yesterday. Please send me some sun and heat. All right. So where are we kicking it off today? Well, I thought one of the interesting places that we might start, and hold on, let's see if Skype is going to play for us this morning. Because I had a couple things I was going to play for us yesterday. Hey, and look at it. It just mysteriously works now, and it didn't yesterday. Here we go. So we've been talking about, so I got to disconnect this, though, because I can't stand that his. We've been talking about all kinds of crazy stuff, vaccinations, this current alert over measles. I noticed the measles debate seemed to tamp down a little bit yesterday. I didn't see a lot of news about it. But it's because they've already launched a firestorm. But check this out. So I found the story over the weekend that was about this study that they were doing in New York City on the subway system. And it was called, I don't know if they had a name for it. It was in phys.org. Researchers produced the first map of New York City subway system microbes. I don't know if you caught that. It was probably a couple days ago that came out, February 5th, so 5 days ago. The microbes that call the New York City subway system home are mostly harmless. Now, if anyone's ever been in New York and you've been in the subway, like, in the beginning, when you first go there, you don't realize how gross it is. But I used to go there back in the late 80s, early to mid 90s. And that was right at the time where they were warning everyone that there was flesh-eating bacteria living on all the payphones. So don't use payphones. And of course, it was the days before cells. So you couldn't, you know, if you had to call someone, you had to go use a payphone. So it was pretty amusing. And I remember the panic ensuing over that. Used to see lines of people standing at the payphones, then there was nobody. But here we go. So this didn't surprise me much because, I mean, it's been 20, 30 years of flesh-eating bacteria. But here we go. So they mapped the microbes on the subway system, and most of them were harmless. But they even found DNA fragments associated with anthrax and bubonic plague, according to citywide microbiome maps published today from the Weill Cornell Medical College investigators. The study published in Cell Systems. Now, this is the part that caught me. Of course, they're going to make headlines, and we're going to look at some of this because there's some even creepier stuff that came out of the study. But it's not the creepy stuff that came out of the study that concerns me. It's the fact that they made a highly, highly accurate map using DNA of microbes to map a very large public transportation system. So if they can take just generic microbes and start making a map of something using DNA strands, let's put on our thinking caps for a minute and fast forward 5 years into the future and think about forensic medicine. Think about this net dropping on us for us to not have any privacy, for us to be spied on, for us to be tracked, for us not to have anywhere to go once the doors close. And so when I started looking at this, I was like, holy shit, these people are going to like the nth degree to make sure that we're not going anywhere. We can't get away. We're not going to be able to hide anything. And once they start messing with our cells and injecting us with nanotechnology in vaccines or whatever the hell they want to put in vaccines, once they force them all and make them mandatory, they're going to be able to pick up a cough droplet, a spit ball that flies, a piece of chewing gum. I actually, if I play a video, I'll have to search for this other one. It may actually be back online. I'm not sure. But there was a story probably a year ago about this woman, and I thought she was in New York. Maybe she was in Philly. But she was going around collecting genetic information from people, from things like chewing gum or hair or, I don't know, different items that people discard on the street. And she had access to a lab. And what she did was she recreated their faces from their DNA and made these masks out of them that she then turned into art. Now, if that's not freaking scary, I don't know what is. And this woman did it from pieces of chewing gum and stuff. Anyway. All right, let's read a little bit more. The study published in Cell Systems demonstrates that it is possible and useful to develop a pathogen map, dubbed a patho map, of a city with the heavily traveled subway as a proxy for New York's population. It is a baseline assessment, and repeated sampling could be used for long-term accurate disease surveillance, bioterrorism threat mitigation, and large-scale health management. For New York, there you go, health management. Ding, 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 says the study senior investigator Christopher E. Mason, an assistant professor at the Weill Cornell's Department of Physiology and Biophysics and in the HRH Prince Alawid bin Talib bin Al Azulid Al Saud Institute for Computational Biomedicine. What the fuck is that? We got Saudi-sponsored biomedical institutes? Wait, let's read that again. I got to copy and paste it into chat for you. The HRH, Prince Alawid bin Talal bin Abdulaziz Al Saud Institute for Computational Biomedicine. Stat. I'm going to drop this into chat. Somebody needs to find that for me. What the hell is that? I've never heard of that. Is that in this country, or are we sending our microbes over to Saudi Arabia to identify? That's really freaky. All right. The pathomap findings are generally reassuring, indicating no need to avoid the subway system or to use protective gloves, says Mason. Phew. The majority of the 637 known bacterial, viral, fungal, and animal species he and his co-authors detected were non-pathogenic and represent normal bacteria present on the human skin and the human body. Culture experiments revealed that all subway sites tested possessed live bacteria. Now, this is another part that kind of surprised me, and it makes you wonder, huh? Strikingly, though, about half of the sequences of DNA they collected could not be identified. They did not match any organism known to the National Center for Biotechnology Information or from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Huh. Half of the DNA collected had no match anywhere. And actually, hold on. There was another story about the same, very same thing that came out even more recently. And I even pulled that quote out of there. It says, this is out of the New York Times. It says, almost half of the DNA found on the system's surfaces did not match any known organism. And just 0.2% match the human genome. So, what the hell is in our subway system? And if you remember last summer, they did some sort of DHS test in New York City. Do you remember that? Where they were going to spray some pathogen with very low illness rates in there to track how a bioterror attack would happen in the New York City subway system. But half of the DNA they found, they cannot identify. That's frightening. That's very frightening. What is it? That's what I want to know. What is it then? If it's not human, and only 0.2% is human, and more than 50% isn't in any database for biotechnology information, the National Center for Biotechnology Information, or the CDC. These represent organisms that New Yorkers touch every day, but they were uncharacterized and undiscovered until the study. The findings underscore the vast potential for scientific exploration that is still largely untapped and yet right under scientists' fingers. Quote, our data shows evidence that most bacteria in these densely populated, highly trafficked transit areas are neutral to human health. Well, so they think. How do they know that they're neutral? They haven't found them inside anyone's body yet. Just because they don't know what they are, but they haven't attributed anything to that, how can you say they're neutral? That's very foolhardy of him. And much of it is commonly found on the skin or in the gastrointestinal tract. Well, yeah, except for that 50%. These bacteria may even be helpful since they can out-complete any dangerous bacteria. Well, that was just a line of bullshit to stop people from getting all panicky over the fact that they don't know what half of it is. But researchers also said that 12% of the bacteria species they sampled shows some association with disease. For example, live antibiotic-resistant bacteria were present in 27% of the samples they collected. Now, remember, there was an executive order passed about this in September or October about them putting all this money and research now into these different pathogens that no longer respond to treatments. I'm sure that this study has something to do with that. And, of course, what better place to start but New York City subway? And they detected two samples with DNA fragments of Bacillus anthracis, which is anthrax, and three samples with a plasmid associated with Yersinia pestis. I don't know. I didn't take Latin, which was the bubonic plague, both at very low levels. Notably, the presence of these DNA fragments do not indicate that they are alive, and culture experiments showed no evidence of them being alive. Phew! These apparently virulent organisms are not linked to widespread sickness or disease, says Dr. Mason. They are instead likely just the cohabitants of any shared urban infrastructure and city, but wider testing is needed to determine how common this is in other cities. Well, guys, here we go. This is going to take us, you know, as we've been digging into nanomedicine, precision healthcare, and all this research that's now going into cracking the genome and coming up with RNAi-based treatments. Do you see what's happening here? They can build, and we listened to that interview last week between Ray Kurzweil and the father of nanotechnology, Eric Drexler. And they can build nanomachines. They have computing power in a cubic micron that you have on your desktop. So as they start understanding now these ecosystems of bacteria and viruses that are living in our environment, you heard them say that this is going to be a way that they maybe can start tracking, you know, bioterror breakouts or the public health. They're going to have monitoring systems. And who's to say, I mean, some of this crazy stuff I've been reading, I mean, this isn't even crazy stuff. This is some real science that they're doing in the lab right now, but they're like reprogramming bacteria to do stuff. You don't see how biological machines, I mean, this really has gone off the edge of sanity. We are a biological machine, but we're a biological machine that evolved over millions of years and maybe came from, I mean, I don't think that we just evolved from fish, maybe some aquatic bacteria that then somehow split into more cells that then somehow sprouted legs and came on land. I mean, I don't know. Maybe. Or maybe there was an asteroid that hit here that then had some sort of other building blocks of life and we became the hominids. Honestly, I don't know. There's gaps in the historical record. You know, even between the... it's early, so don't quote me. I am only on a half a cup at the moment. But, you know, from some of the earlier hominids to now the Homo sapiens sapien that we are today, they still have not found that missing link that's taken us from the more primitive man to now. So who knows? But all I'm saying is that happened over millions of years. Now, okay, I don't want to get into this argument because it's going to derail the whole conversation. There is question. Okay, they do say that there was not enough evolutionary time for us to become Homo sapiens sapiens from the last Neanderthal. And so there's something curious happening there. But I'm just saying that now with this... Oh, I don't remember what it's called. There's something from using computers to build technology to then give us more computational power to build the next generation of technology. That's what's leading us to the singularity, the stuff that Kurzweil talks about, the merging of man and machine, okay? It's exponential growth of thinking power. And as we're continuing down this path, it is giving us the powers of gods. And we don't morally or ethically deserve that, I don't think, as a species. You look around this planet with death and destruction and greed and all this stuff that's going on, the slaughter of living beings, the disrespect for everything. And do you think that this is going to be in the right hands? Because I don't. All right, I'm not going to read any more about this because I really, really want to kind of get back to where we were. But the one thing I do want to do is to play you this clip because there was a clip. Pigmind found a clip last night that went along with this microbial finding in the subway system. Oh, please tell me that it's now going to work. Oh, it's trying. No, now it's telling me that UCY is busy and... it doesn't let me connect. Are you fucking kidding me? This is exactly what it did to me yesterday. Hold on. We're going to try one more time. I'm telling you, shit works, and then it doesn't. And all I got to say is, good. I hope I am really on the right track then. Hey, there we go. You know, even bumpers have just stopped working out of the blue, but not all of them, just certain ones. You know, I don't know. It's getting pretty irritating to me. So any glitches, you know what? Give me a free pass because it's not me. All right, here we go. Study finds New York City subways are crawling with germs.
An average of 5.5 million people ride the New York City subway system every day. So it's only natural that it would be teeming with bacteria. A new study called PathoMap took over 3,000 samples from all of the subway stations to map the microgenomics of the city, something that has never been done before. And the findings may surprise you, even gross you out. What would you say if I told you that scientists just found 100 different strands of bacteria in New York City subway stations?
That is really gross, and I don't even
it's actually scary.
Obviously, that is very concerning.
Also shocking, almost half the DNA that was sampled is unidentifiable, meaning they do not match any other known organisms known to scientists. The study collected samples from turnstiles, garbage cans, subway poles, benches, and in some subway stations, they found microbes of meningitis, anthrax, E. coli, even the bubonic plague.
Oh.
It's time to start practicing good hand washing.
Now that's gross. That's gross.
But don't worry. The bacteria poses no threat to public safety.
Of course not.
Incredibly low levels, and some of them, they weren't even active. In fact, they also found good bacteria. In hearing this and learning this, is that going to change the way you ride the subways?
Definitely.
And is it going to change the way you ride the subways now?
No, because I've always rode the subways with my hands in my pocket or even, you know, sitting down trying to touch anything.
The bacteria found in the subway is really not all that different from the amount found above ground. I mean, we're surrounded by countless bacteria and we're doing just fine. But that's not going to stop me from using my sanitizer. Stay clean.
There you go.
Oh, my God. So, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what the point was, at least to release that to the public. I mean, are they trying to say, well, look, don't worry about all these pathogens because they're all around us. Now, that clip didn't really talk about the whole mapping project, but I think that what's behind that is the mapping project, because there was another story that came out on the same day, as a matter of fact, from Scientific American. So the first one I read was from phys.org. This one's from Scientific American, which is one of my publications back from the 80s. I mean, people say, oh, don't trust scientists. Well, I at least read what they have to say. You know, you don't know who's financing the research. True. But on the other hand, there's got to be some truth in there somewhere. Newly discovered networks among different diseases reveal hidden connections. What? And at first I thought this was almost the same story, but it absolutely is not. And this is where it ties back into precision medicine, in my personal opinion. Enormous, this is how it starts out too, enormous databases of medical records. Haven't we been talking about this? The Electronic Medical Health Record Initiative, which ties in with precision medicine. Enormous databases of medical records have begun to reveal connections among diseases that could provide insights into the biological missteps that make us sick. Yes, give it up. Give up your HIPAA. Give up your privacy for the good of all, because we will be able to cure everybody if we know every detail about you. Stefan Turner is a physicist, not a biologist, but not long ago, the Austrian National Health Insurance Clearinghouse asked Turner and his colleagues at the Medical University of Vienna to examine some data for them. The data, it turned out, were the anonymized medical claims records. Every diagnosis made, every treatment given of most of the people in the country, which numbers some 8 million people. Now, guys, I had not seen this before we started talking about the electronic medical health records, the loss of HIPAA protections for privacy and precision healthcare 3 weeks ago. But this outlines to me that's exactly what they're planning to do. The question was whether the same standard of care could continue if, as had recently happened in Greece, a third of the funding had evaporated. But Turner thought there were other deeper questions that the data can answer as well. In a recent paper in the New Journal of Physics, Turner and his colleagues Peter Klimek and Anna Shamil started looking at the prevalence of 1,055 diseases in the overall population. They ran statistical analyses to uncover the risks of having two diseases together, identifying pairs of diseases for which the percentage of people who had both was higher than would be expected if the diseases were uncorrelated. In other words, a patient who had one disease was more likely than the average person to have another. They applied statistical corrections to reduce the risk of false connections between very rare and very common diseases, as any error in diagnosis would get magnified in such an analysis. And don't forget, in the middle of all of this, and maybe not in wherever they are, Austria, but here in the United States, they have been working with cognitive computing, IBM and Watson, to help take over medical diagnoses. So I'm sure that this research is going to help that right along. Finally, the team displayed their results as a network in which diseases are nodes on the network that connect to one another when they tend to occur together. Now, in nature, they discovered a long time ago that the biggest network on Earth is actually the fungal network in the forests. They all connect together and communicate together across the floors of the forests. So it's interesting to find that bacteria and viruses may have the same sort of ecosystem where they depend upon each other. The style of the analysis has uncovered some unexpected links in another paper published on the scientific preprint site arvix.org. Hey, that might be a good one for anyone who's into doing some research, SLC and others. ARX, oh, it's Arxivig. Who even knows? ARXIV.org. Thurner's team confirmed a controversial connection between diabetes and Parkinson's disease, as well as unique patterns in the timing of when diabetics develop high blood pressure. In the paper, in the New Journal of Physics, generated an additional connection that they hope to investigate further. Eventually, Thurner and a growing number of other researchers hope to use these disease networks to generate hypotheses on how diseases operate at a molecular level. That's when we start getting into nanotech. Is this disease caused by a gene, Thurner asks. Is it caused by a defect in the metabolic network, or is it due to environmental things that affect certain genes? Things like this is the aim, unquote. The work is being driven by the realization that diseases, as defined in medicine, sound like tidy, distinct entities, but they are messier in reality. Diseases tend to be defined by other systems, but the molecular roots of a disease may have biological effects that go far beyond our current understanding. And I will tell you something. Everything we understand goes far beyond our current understanding. I will absolutely attest to. Certain diseases tend to follow others or have high rates of comorbidity. And though it isn't clear why, it may be because they arise from related biological flaws. Yes, biological flaws that at some point in the future they will be able to identify and terminate before you are ever born. Actually, I want to hop over really quick to this story that came out a few days ago. This is just another example of what we need to be careful of as they get to this precision medicine. Women with learning disabilities can now be forcibly sterilized per decision by a UK judge. We also saw last year in Belgium, there was a big push for euthanasia for children who were up to the age of 9, I believe, with developmental disabilities. And trust me, as I tell you, that as they continue to push this climate change and they continue to push reducing carbon, and they continue to push the fact that, oh no, we're now having droughts and we can't produce food, or oh no, we're running out of water. Anyone who's ever watched a dystopian show or movie where they're stranded and they start running out of resources, people are then asked to sacrifice themselves for the good of the greater toward the end of things. You know, this isn't a game anymore. This isn't fantasy. This isn't bullshit. A judge has decided that they can forcibly sterilize a woman with learning disabilities. Who's to decide what's a learning disability? You know, one genetic swab, bloop, for your precision medicine to go into the electronic medical healthcare records, and they determine that you have under 100 IQ. Well, hey, guess what there, Charlie? We've decided that you will not be able to procreate. And the next round, we're going to decide that you are a burden to society, so you must take this long walk off the short pier. You know, this isn't funny. This sets precedent, and especially when it's a legal ruling And I know it's in the UK, but pay attention. They're trying little test beds of this stuff all over in all of these New World Order countries that have been toppled and taken over. These are just sticking little toes in the water to see what kind of a reaction there's going to be. And hey, nobody's standing up with pitchforks and torches. The plan can continue. A judge has ruled, and here we'll read this. A judge has ruled that a mother of six with learning disabilities can be forcibly sterilized in a decision he described as exceptional. Mr. Justice Cobb authorized health authorities and social services to force entry into the woman's home and use quote unquote necessary restraint in order to sterilize her. The ruling was made at a hearing in the Court of Protection in London, where issues related to sick and vulnerable people are examined. Now, coming on the heels of the story we read yesterday of the quote-unquote Christian holistic couple that had a home birth with twins that they hunted down like animals and found in Santa Cruz, California with a see something, say something, and took away all three of their babies. This should be getting pretty disturbing to you. And remember, this whole precision medicine, like I've been saying, this is about losing the ability to have the rights over every cell in your body. We are right now in front of our very eyes losing our say in what happens to our physical being. We're being usurped. We're being assimilated. The last step is once they get all the nanotech into us. And I mean, they've been working on it for a long time, but it's coming, and it's coming very quickly. The judge said that the medical, legal, and ethical issues arising from the case were of the utmost gravity and insisted the decision was not about eugenics. Health authorities and social services had argued that such a move was in the best interest of the woman, whose life would be in danger if she became pregnant again. I mean, granted, six children in this day and age is a lot. I mean, I don't know what kind of learning disability she had. There are very mild learning disabilities versus very severe learning disabilities. But on the other hand, who has the right to go in and to tell you that you have to be forcibly sterilized, or, I mean, shit, that you have to be forcibly vaccinated, or shit, we have to forcibly remove the part of your brain that does critical thinking? I mean, is that coming next? The woman who is in her 30s has had children taken from her and has repeatedly refused with medical and social services staff, saying she just wants to be left alone. Health and social services officials say they face difficulties trying to persuade the woman to use contraception. And I mean, they have been doing this stuff in the United States as well. I know that there were some cases. I mean, historically, we can go back through eugenics cases back about a year and a half ago. I did a lot of reading into that. And there are some horrific stories. And I mean, there's maps. Oh my God. It's pretty unbelievable that we'd ever gone down that path, but it looks like we're coming back to it again. Barrister Michael Horn, who represented the interests of the woman, said sterilization was required to mitigate the grave risks that she would face to her health if she became pregnant again. She had a history of trying to conceal pregnancies from health workers. He ruled that the woman could be restrained and sedated when giving birth to her sixth child, and a planned cesarean was determined to be the best option for delivery. Restrained. He declared that because of the woman lacked the mental capacity to make decisions regarding contraception, quote unquote, therapeutic sterilization would be lawful and in her best interests. Quote, The ethical, legal, and medical issues arising here are self-evidently of the utmost gravity, engaging and profoundly impacting on the woman's personal autonomy, privacy, bodily integrity, and reproductive rights. This is, in my judgment, an exceptional case in its facts, and the applicants seek a range of relief which is likely to arise only in the most extreme circumstances. The risk to the woman of a future pregnancy, especially if concealed, is likely to lead to her death. Well, isn't that her choice? Oh, but you know what? She is developmentally disabled. She is learning disabilities, and so she can't make that decision for herself. The judge authorized health and social services staff to, quote, remove the woman from her home and take steps to convey her to the hospital for the purposes of sterilization procedures. He said necessary and proportionate steps could include forced entry and necessary restraint. Yeah, very good question. Where are her other children? That, to me, was horrifying. All right, back to this Scientific American story about bacteria and viruses depending upon each other and living in some sort of symbiotic relationship. Biologists typically look for genetic connections by using genome-wide association studies, which statistically associate genetic markers with disease, but at the Harvard Medical School, another research team is attempting to find the same connections by mapping networks of a different kind, the molecular networks at work at a cellular level. The inside of a cell seethes with activity as tiny molecules, enormous proteins, and strands of DNA wash around each other, going about their business. And each actor's business is some set of other actors. A protein, for instance, might snip off a piece of other proteins, ferry molecules around, or jumpstart the manufacturing of DNA. It takes cues from other actors, which can make it work faster or more slowly, or send it off to distant regions where it is needed. The functioning of a cell can take on very different characters if even a single member of this molecular social network starts to behave oddly. Before long, the effects ripple outward from the initial flaw, causing problems, i.e. disease, on the level of the organism. The disease is in some sense just an expression of the underlying dynamics of the social structure. There are hopes that the disease networks can eventually help uncover some flaws. Guys, they are coming to a point where there will be no mysteries anymore. We are a biological machine that, as they learn more and more, they're going to be able to enable and disable at will. I'm going to drop you that story because it continues on and on, but it's hair-raising. It's very scary. All right, here, we're going to pop back now to someplace that we tried to go yesterday. This is New World Order shill, good old meet you, Kaku. It's actually just a few minutes long, but this is meet you talking about the future of nanotech. This is from August of last year. Remember I told you he's been now on the mainstream science shows, if anyone's seen him recently over the last year or so, talking about how man should merge with machine. I just can't even believe that he's jumped on this. Actually, here, we're going to go here first, because here's a different one about meet you. Oh, maybe. Here we go. All right, hold on. I might have to connect us and mute. All right. Let's connect. Hopefully it lets me. I think we're connected. Maybe. Ah, there we go. All right. Let's play this.
Well, we are definitely biological genes. Okay, there's no question about that. The question is, what does that mean? Okay, what does that mean for people's feelings about the universe, sense of who they are? Are humans special in that sense from animals? Well, I look at a continuum. If you take a look at our own evolution, and you were to believe, for example, that only humans are conscious, which is the dominant position of most psychologists and most people in the field, that humans really are different. We are conscious, animals are not. That is the dominant position in the entire field. But if you take a look at our evolutionary history, at what point did we suddenly become conscious? There's a continuum of our ancestors going back millions, in fact, billions of years. And then you say, well, at what point did we suddenly become conscious? And then you begin to realize that, hey, this is a stupid question. Consciousness itself probably has a continuum. It has stages, as I mentioned, but consciousness probably has a continuum. And so in that sense, we are linked to the animal kingdom. Now, are we special? Again, it depends on how you define special, how you define soul. What I'm saying is, if you give me a criterion, that is, are we XYZ, then what I say is, okay, how do you measure it? Give me an experiment that I can put a human in a box by which I can measure this criterion that you give me. So are we biological machines? And the answer is yes. But what does that mean? Does a machine have a soul? Does a machine have something more? Well, define more. Define soul. Define essence. Give me a criteria, give me a definition, and then I will give you an experiment by which we can differentiate yes and no. That's
where we're headed. The experimental portion of all this. All right. So that was also from August of 2014. But let's continue, because this is now where Michio hops on and starts explaining the future of nanotechnology and man merging with machine.
We have to realize that if robots become more sophisticated, more intelligent, there is a chance that they could become very, very superior to us, in which case we should think about merging with them. Now, this, of course, will be done democratically. People will choose if they want to merge with robots. This is not going to be forced on people.
It's not going to be forced on people. Did you hear that? Robots probably will become more intelligent than us, so we will be forced to merge with them. But it will be a democratic process, so just don't worry about it.
Now, it sounds unpleasant to some people because they have this vision of having implants dangling from their head, looking like some monster robot from a science fiction movie. They realize that these so-called implants could be microscopic. With nanotechnology, we may be able to enhance the power of the mind and the brain in a way that is basically invisible. You wouldn't be able to tell if a person has been enhanced this way or not.
Where did he go?
The Holy Grail of nanotech.
Well, the Holy Grail of nanotechnology is the replicator. That is, you simply ask for something, and the device changes whatever you put into it into what you want. This is straight out of Star Trek. Now, some people said that, well, the key to a replicator is a nanobot. That is a microscopic robot that you can't even see, that cuts atoms apart, that cuts molecules, rearranges molecules. So you take a glass and you change it into a dish, and you take a bunch of dishes and you turn it into a table. That's the power of a magician. Now, is that even physically possible? Some people said it's too much. It's asking too much of a nanobot. But you see, nanobots already exist in one form. Mother Nature has already created a nanobot. Mother Nature can take a bunch of hamburgers and French fries and turn it into a baby in 9 months. That is amazing. How do you do that? How does Mother Nature turn hamburgers into a baby in 9 months? By ribosomes, which cut apart DNA and protein molecules at precise points and rearrange them. That is a miracle. A molecule that takes apart hamburgers one by one and creates a baby in 9 months. So it is possible, though, of course, to re-engineer it
would take a technology far beyond anything that we have at the present time. Now, some people think that a nanobot is going to look like something right out of a construction site. It's going to have tongs, it's going to have a welding thing, it's going to have clippers, and it's going to look like something that you would imagine from a Lego set. Well, there are criticisms of that, because at the atomic scale, quantum effects start to come into play. And quantum mechanics says that there's uncertainty. You don't really know precisely the location of an atom. And so this object that we visualize in our mind, a nanobot with clippers and with blowtorches and with the ability to cut molecules at a precise point, that's not possible. We have something called the Casimir effect. Quantum effects, that as you get close to molecules, they are repelled and they come toward you. So this is the sticky fat fingers problem. That if you have a nanobot with clippers cutting DNA at certain points, the hands are actually rather sticky because of the Casimir effect. And they are like gloves. They're not very precise. Now, I believe that it is possible, but it's a technology that is still far more advanced than what we have at the present time. Mother Nature does it. But look, Mother Nature has had 3.5 billion years to play with things like nanobots. We've only done this for a few decades. So, you know, give us a break. It's going to take time. So don't expect replicators anytime soon. I think they are probably possible within the laws of physics, but it'll take many long decades before we can create a nanobot. Well, first, we have to understand the past. Take a look at civilization hundreds of years ago. Back in the 1700s, what was long-distance communication in the 1700s? Long-distance communication was yelling out the window. That's how people communicated, by yelling at each other. What was high-speed travel in the 1700s? Getting stuck in the mud with a wagon, if you could even afford a wagon. But what happened? We physicists worked out something called thermodynamics. We could calculate how much energy you can extract from a lump of coal, and that created the Industrial Revolution. Steam engines allowed us to create locomotives, which allowed us to replace human labor and sail across continents in a matter of days. This was unimaginable during feudal times. So in the 1800s, we had the steam revolution, the Industrial Revolution. In the 1900s, we physicists began to harness electricity and magnetism. That electrified whole continents, giving us the electric age. And then in the last 50 years, we physicists worked out transistors and lasers, giving us high technology. The space program, iPods, iPads, telecommunications, the internet, GPS, all of that coming from quantum physics. So we've had three waves of innovation: steam power, electricity and magnetism, and high technology. Now, what is the fourth wave? This is the big question. What will dominate the rest of the 21st century? I think it's going to be a combination of molecular physics, that is, nanotechnology, that is the physics of molecules used in manufacturing at the molecular level, biotechnology, where we have quantum mechanics govern the motions of DNA, which controls life, and then artificial intelligence, because now we're reducing the circuitry of the brain down to neurons. And so I think these three molecular technologies will propel us into the future.
All right.
So New World Order, chill. Michio Kaku tells us it's way into the future. Notice how, and this was the August of 2014, but I can guarantee you that this was going on before that. Notice how he's saying it's way into the future, except there are already clinical trials and vaccinations that they have been injecting into people with some of this newfangled technology. Now, they may not have nanobots per se that they're putting into people, but we found a clip here the other day that was from the old Pigmind 5 channel. So this was already from last year that came out and talked about them creating cancer-destroying nanobots out of a lab in South Korea. Remember that? And that is 100% technology that they're messing around with already.
Scientists in South Korea may have created a breakthrough in cancer treatment. Using nanotechnology, the researchers claim to have created a robot that, when ingested, can seek out and destroy cancer cells without causing any harm to healthy cells. The nanorobot, dubbed Bacteriobot, uses genetically modified non-toxic Salmonella bacteria to detect cancer cells. The bacteria push a robotic capsule filled with anti-cancer drugs toward those cells. Once the tumor is reached, the drugs are released. The technology has not yet been tested on humans, but researchers say it was successful in mice. Currently, the nanorobot is only effective at detecting tumor-causing cancers, such as breast and colorectal cancer. The Bacteriobot could eliminate the side effects generally associated with cancer treatments like chemotherapy, such as nausea, hair loss, and digestive problems. While the technology has already been patented, it has not yet been approved for use on humans. Nick Dietz, CBS News.
And it hasn't been approved for use in humans, just like the Ebola RNAi treatments weren't approved for use in humans. Remember, all these biopharma companies that are now part of the precision medicine triage that we're all going to get have pipelines with products that are waiting for human trials. And the only way for them to approve that is to declare some sort of emergency. Now, did you see, as of 2014, I believe cancer has now jumped to number one as the cause of death here in the United States. I'm sure there are many, many, many reasons for that. Our environment, our food, our air, our water, Fukushima, among natural causes. I mean, I'm sure that there are probably some natural causes that still exist out there, probably very small compared to man-made causes. But don't think that there aren't going to be clinical trials, because there are every day. And they prey upon those who are sick, those who are desperate, those who have, I mean, some of these Ebola clinical trials, healthy people actually lined up to get those injections to see what would happen. Why? I mean, they pay you for a lot of those. Sometimes, if you're not sick and dying, if you're a healthy participant. I remember in college, people used to get all excited because they would put the listings in the paper every week, and they'd go, as a college kid, they'd go make money being involved in clinical trials. But this technology, even though, you know, like I said, anything out of mainstream, anything out of the public, you need to decode. And though they tell us that it's not here yet, though they tell us there haven't been human trials, I'm going to tell you that that's probably a half-truth, like we saw with Brian Williams. And, you know, Brian Williams is just one. I could guarantee you that probably a majority of the mainstream anchors have told tall tales or have reported news that was given to them. You know, I saw a story here from early hours of this morning that I thought was interesting about this.
For journalists in this country, the realization that the government is spying on their communications is becoming more and more common. That's according to a new study from the Pew Research Center. It reports that nearly 7 in 10 journalists believe that the Obama administration has, in fact, spied on them. But where is the media pushback against all of this? RT's Lindsay France joins me live from Los Angeles to talk more about it. Lindsay, so obviously a lot of journalists seem to believe this, not sure if they have proof of it, but they feel this way. Is it affecting how they report stories?
Yes, it is. Now, this article came from the Washington Examiner, which pulled information from the Pew Research Center. So it completed a study on how journalists were responding to reports that large numbers of investigative reporters, especially, had their communications hacked. So out of the 454 media figures that were polled, 64% believed that the U.S. government has probably collected data on them, not only from their phone calls, but their emails as well. Now, 13% of the journalists responding to this poll say spying or hacking problems led to them not reaching out to a source. 3% declined to pursue a particular story because of that, and 2% considered leaving investigative journalism altogether. More information on top of that. In the past 12 months alone, 49% of the respondents changed the way they store and share information. 29% changed the way they communicate with fellow reporters, editors, and producers.
Pretty interesting stuff. If we look at the numbers here.
Yeah, we're not going to have time to listen to all that. But guys, that's what I'm saying. I mean, they're spying on people. People are being told. There were reports that came out about the L.A. Times reporter, I think he was. He was an L.A. journalist. Anyway, I know he's out of Los Angeles, who had a pretty chummy relationship with someone in the Department of Defense or some sort of alphabet agency. And he was actually clearing his stories and letting them rewrite sections of his stories before he wrote them or aired them. So don't think that this isn't going on. I mean, of course, we know it's going on, but now the proof is out there. We're being spied on. We're being told what to say. We're being told what to believe. So don't believe anything you hear. Put on your thinking cap. You know, I'm going to have to make this show 2 hours because we're just about out of time, and I haven't even touched anything that I had planned to touch yet this morning. I can't extend it today, but I'll have to look at the schedule tonight. I need to do some retooling. I don't know. We'll see here. We'll see. All right, guys. Well, it is Tuesday. Tuesday is always an exciting night. Make sure you stick around because Mr. Kevin Blanche is up next. And then we have live 6 p.m. Mr. Chuck Ocelli, 6 p.m. Eastern. All Things Apocalyptic with G. Michael Hoff at 8. Primer Time Live with Michael and Nick at 9 p.m. Eastern. Prepper Chicks After Dark with Prepper Chick and her consortium of roundtable participants. And then Anti-Media Radio with S.M. Gibson and Diedrich Young at 11. All right, guys. Everybody have a happy Tuesday. I hope that you have less snow than I do. Keep away from the nanobots. We are going to hit nanobots and nanotechnology in food starting first thing tomorrow, so I can't get off topic. All right, guys, everyone have a great day. We will catch up with you later. Take care.